This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're broadcasting from the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry this hour in Portland. And before we begin the program, I got an idea I want to share with all of you because it has something to do with this program. I've got an idea for something called Senior Jeopardy. Now, you know what regular Jeopardy is. Somebody rings in within 3 seconds or microseconds of the question. But if you're like me at home, you're sitting there saying, I know that answer. You know, give me a few minutes. I think Senior Jeopardy should allow 3 or 5 minutes for people to answer that question. And then we have a separate show that we who, you know, can't remember the name of something yesterday but can remember something 50 years ago very easily will have a chance at. And maybe it sounds like you. Maybe you're over 50 like I am because, you know, as we get older, we tend to lose some of our brain capacity. Things just don't come to us as quickly and easily as they used to. Maybe a slightly diminished memory isn't a big problem, but it gets us to worrying about, well, if we're having trouble recalling, you know, the capital of Washington State, maybe we're on our way to Alzheimer's somehow. A lot of us think that way, and we get questions about that on Science Friday all the time. So this hour we're going to talk about some of the problems our aging population faces, including Alzheimer's disease, other kinds of diseases. We're also going to take a look at the health care older Americans are getting. In fact, a new study in this week's issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association says older Americans suffer about 500,000 preventable drug side effects each year. And we'll look at some of the reasons why seniors are especially vulnerable to this problem. We'll also take a look at studies that look at the very old, people at 85 and older. Can they tell us something about how we can get there, too? What are the secrets to healthy aging? That's the fountain of youth question. And can small changes in your lifestyle help you to live longer and happier lives? So that's what we'll be talking about this hour. It's Brain Awareness Week here in Portland. And if you're here in the audience at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, I invite you to step up to the microphones, ask a question. Oregon is a good place to talk about aging issues because this is one of the 3 states that is projected to have the highest percentage of older people by the year 2020. 1 in 5 people here will be 65 years and older. So if you're listening on the radio or on the web, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you're invited to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. So let me introduce our guest this hour, starting on the end of the table. Dr. Elizabeth Kutza is the director of the Institute on Aging at the Portland State University. She's here with us today. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Jeffrey Kay is the director of geriatric neurology at the Portland Veterans Administration Hospital and the director of latent aging and Alzheimer's Disease Center at the Oregon Health and Science University. And thank you for being with us, Dr. Kay.
Thank you.
Dr. Christine Castle is the dean of the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. And she is co-editor of the Practical Guide to Aging, published by New York University Press. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Castle. Let me start with you, Dr. Castle. What are the biggest health issues affecting older people, aging people?
There are many different illnesses that are health factors affecting older people. But the biggest challenge, I think, is finding health care that can manage multiple illnesses at the same time. We have a wonderful system of supporting specialists and research in each of the special areas, and we're going to hear talk more about that today. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the challenges facing older people as they want to stay active and functional and maintain their quality of their lives, there are very few physicians or healthcare systems that are really equipped to coordinate all that. You mentioned that JAMA study about mm-hmm. the medication side effects. The reason older people are susceptible to that is because, one, they have, as you age, you become more sensitive to drug side effects, but also you're taking more medications. And mostly you're taking more medications for very good reasons, because we have very effective treatments for most chronic illnesses related to aging, but then those drugs interact with each other, too. Mm-hmm. So the specialty of geriatric medicine, which is my specialty, is a very important specialty as the population ages. And as of yet, very few young people are going into that.
So. Well, that was my next question.
Yeah.
I mean, did you take this in med school? Was there anything called geriatric medicine?
No, when I was in medical school, our biggest challenge was to find the interesting, unusual disease in a young person, because that was exotic and hard to diagnose. And meanwhile, all the patients were older people with common diseases, and we weren't learning very much about that. Now, that, I think, has changed in the last 20 years, but the specialty of geriatric medicine is still relatively underrepresented. In medical schools, there's only three departments of geriatric medicine in medical schools around the country, and we really need ways of supporting more young people to go into this field, both in nursing and in medicine.
So you have to, if you're an older person, then you have to seek out
right.
the right person.
Right. You have to seek out someone who is interested in the problems of aging and knowledgeable. I mean,
right.
There is a whole body of knowledge about these complex issues facing older people. And often you do need to see specialists for various disorders, mm-hmm. but each specialist doesn't know what the other specialist is doing, and that's why you need the geriatrician.
Mm-hmm. If any of you just want to jump in, you know, feel free. If I don't call on you. Dr. Kutzer, what can people do to make this, besides looking for somebody who specializes in geriatric medicine, can they do for... seems like you go to the doctors, a lot of the time you're on your own. You have to almost be your own doctor in many cases to figure out your own alternatives. What can older people do to be proactive?
Well, there are two answers you could have to that question. One has to do with the proactive I'll hang on to for a moment. Mm-hmm. But the... In the first case, I would say that it's very important, I think, no matter what your age is, but certainly for older people, to have an advocate with them when they encounter the healthcare system, someone who comes with them. Frequently what we'll find is that if an older person comes for a visit, and again, I say that it affects all of us at any age, you're not quite hearing everything that,
right.
that has been said. You're under stress. You're anxious. You may get confused about the medication that you're being prescribed. You may not quite understand what it's for. So trying to bring someone with you to the physician's office, trying to have an advocate if you need hospitalization, if you need some more other kind of extended care for rehabilitation, for example, I think is an important first step in making sure that you're going to be assured better care.
My mother, I'll knock on wood, she's 91, and she would hate me saying anything because she's very superstitious about it, says that she's, you know, she has to embark on her own little regimen of exercise and,
yes.
and you know, what?
That, too. I mean, on the other side, in terms of being proactive, it's important. We're learning from research that there are things one can do on the physical side in terms of exercise. There are things one can do on the mental side. We hear the stories about, you know, helping your memory by doing the crossword puzzle, that
right.
the people who are very involved and can keep themselves involved. And we're learning more and more from studies such as the centenarian studies, which are studies looking at people over 100 who have survived that long, that a good mental outlook is very important to a successful aging, where you have enthusiasm still for things that you are still able to do, even though you may be limited in some ways, that you have connectedness to your social world through friends, family, neighbors, that you see the glass as half full rather than half empty. And all of those things we're discovering are important predictors of how well people are growing old.
Ira, if I could just add to that, so it's totally true. This is the use it or lose it motto, which sounds like your mother understands.
Absolutely.
And people have, I think, begun to understand that about physical activity, but it's also true, as Dr. Kutzer said, about mental activity and social engagement, if you will, and social interactions. So then if you back up and you say, well, what are the things that keep people from doing that as they age? Some of those are things that healthcare can help accomplish. For example, if your knees and hips are worn out from arthritis, you may need surgery in order to stay active so that you can stay engaged. If you're having problems with hearing or vision, it makes it much harder to stay mentally active, to do those crossword puzzles, to interact with, make new friends, learn a new language. So the research that is so vitally important is the research that will make it possible for people to stay active.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kay, you're studying, you have a unique study about the brain in aging people. Tell us a bit about that. What goes on there?
Well, we're particularly interested in this group that Beth talked about, the very elderly, arbitrarily defined as 85 and older. I think as time goes on, we keep raising that bar.
That's what my mother says. She says, I don't like all the old people around here.
Right. Well, one of the definitions of old age is 10 years older than your current age. But I think what we're trying to do is to find people who are as healthy as we can find them and as old as we can find them, because we think that they contain the secrets to how to get to a successful old age. And we've identified a number of these individuals in our community here who are 85 or older, who have no diabetes, no heart disease, no cancer, no memory problems, take no medications. They're not very common, but they are very special, and we think they have certain genetic as well as lifestyle or environmental experiences that have helped them get there, and that's the key to understanding how we'll all get there.
Something common that they all do.
Right.
Yeah.
Sounds like you ought to enroll Ira's mother.
Really?
Well, we'll fly her out.
She won't get on a plane. She says that's one of the reasons she's old. Actually, I did hear a woman who was 107 talking about, you know, my mother is very, she fits your profile, Dr. Kutzer, very well. She's very optimistic. She doesn't believe she's old. She's active. She doesn't walk with, you know, walker. She thinks she has to, you know, be very active and keep her doing the crossword puzzles. But I also heard a woman who was 107 interviewed once, and they asked her, everybody wants to know, what is the secret of life? And she said, it's better to be polite than right. And that just said, you know, to me that was the optimistic way of looking at things. Instead of saying having to have the last word all and get into an argument all the time, she was just as happy to say, okay, you're right. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I think another thing that suggests is that people who are easy to get along with, people who are friendly, are the ones who will keep their social networks intact as well. I mean, if you're going to be around someone who is always complaining, always angry, always off-putting, then it becomes more difficult, I think, as you age to retain those relationships and develop new ones.
Dr. Kay, though, can you figure out if that's the cause or effect?
Well, that's the absolute most difficult issue is do people... the 107-year-old individual, did she get there because she was doing all these things during her lifetime and that promoted her being able to get there? Or was she doing these things in her lifetime because her physiology let her do that? So are these people just hardy survivors and it almost wouldn't matter what they did? Or are there actually things that you can do throughout your lifetime that will get you there? And I think, as usual, the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. There's clearly a genetic component that, you know, you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your parents, and you're stuck with some genetic component. But also, there are obviously many things you can do over your lifetime. We just a quick example, we've looked at, in our healthy aging group, smoking, which is, I don't think anybody would argue, is not a great health practice. But surprisingly, a large percentage, 40% of the people in this group, smoked at some point during their life. Currently, less than 5% smoke, and yet they survived quite advanced ages without any illnesses. So there clearly was some kind of protection that we think is perhaps genetic.
You're going to have to really weed through this data. Exciting thing to do, I would think. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Kutzer, Director of the Institute on Aging at Portland State University, Dr. Jeffrey Kay, who is the Director of Geriatric Neurology at the Portland Veterans Administration Hospital and Director of the Latent Aging and Alzheimer's Disease Center at Oregon Health and Science University, Dr. Christine Castle, Dean of the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm Ira Flatow. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about health and aging with my guest, Dr. Elizabeth Kutzer, Director of the Institute on Aging, Portland State University, Dr. Jeffrey Kay, who is the Director of Geriatric Neurology at Portland Veterans Administration Hospital and Director of Latent Aging and Alzheimer's Disease Center at Oregon Health Science University, and Dr. Christine Castle, also Dean of the School of Medicine at OHSU and co-editor of The Practical Guide to Aging, published by New York University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. If you have a question, please, here in the audience, step up to the microphone, and we'll be taking questions on the telephone. But I just want to pursue, Dr. Kay, with you a little bit more in detail about your study. Have you found anything? How do you actually go about studying your patients?
Well, sign people up, they consent, obviously, to essentially a lifelong project where we intensively assess their cognitive or memory function on an annual basis. We very carefully look at their health, their physical health. We take an MRI brain scan to see if certain parts of their brain are shrinking in an unusual fashion. We also get a sample, which they allow us to have, of their DNA and do genetic studies on the DNA to look for genetic risk factors. And many of them, most of them, actually donate their brain to us when they die so that we can ultimately look at the brain and the brain basis for their exceptional cognitive health during life.
Have you found anything yet so far?
We found quite a few things, I think. There are clearly some genetic factors that that differentiate the successful agers from not. I think the one thing that was very surprising to us was when we originally went out to find this group, we thought they'd be very protected from developing dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And the answer was has turned out to be surprising in that they all, well, I shouldn't say all, but they do develop Alzheimer's disease rather surprisingly frequently, but it's delayed. So it's at much later ages than the typical person. And this has led us to believe that it's not so much a question of whether you will develop Alzheimer's disease, but when. So that actually, I think, makes us want to delay as much as possible these changes, ultimately till we're 120, and then it's somebody else's, the cardiologist's problem, perhaps.
Dr. Castle?
Yeah, if I could add, what that tells us is that one of the really important frontiers of research is something that's not so easy for the general public, I think, to understand, which is the fundamental basis of why we age at the cellular level. Instead of looking disease by disease by disease, what Jeff is describing is a phenomenon that actually gerontologists who study the fundamental science of aging have been asking exactly this question. It could be that all of these things are just part of aging, and if we understand how to slow the aging process, we can push it all out so that when people do die, they've escaped most of the ravages of these disabling diseases.
Doctor, have you found any medical reason yet? When you obviously study the brains of these people after they've passed away, correct?
Yes.
Have you found, besides seeing that they all of them had some form of Alzheimer's as a normal part of aging, did you find any other links?
Well, what we most recently found, which is very exciting in many ways, is that a number of individuals have died who were tested, in fact, a couple of cases a week before they died. The testing had nothing to do with their death. I just want to make that clear. But it was absolutely clear they had no memory problem. They were cognitively intact. And when we looked at the brain had a intensity or a density of Alzheimer changes that you would have said, if you didn't know the person before they died, this person must have been severely impaired. And this has led us to believe that there are other protections that exist, and we may in fact be chasing an end stage that is not going to tell us that much about why people ultimately get Alzheimer's
disease. If you find out why those people were protected, then that might turn out to be a medication or some kind of intervention that could protect other people who might be more vulnerable to those changes.
And possibly that might be the genetic factor there.
Exactly.
That protects them. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones to Craig in Boone, North Carolina. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Ira. I hear loud and clear the idea of use it or lose it, and your mother doing her crossword puzzles is using it so that she keeps the machinery intact. But there's another aspect of this mental aspect to aging that I haven't heard any of your panel talk about. I'm surprised, because there is significant research out there that shows that you can reduce or reverse, actually, your biological age, in other words, how much wear and tear the body has undergone, through the practice of transcendental meditation, which gives the body a profound state of rest. And they found that people who have been practicing regularly this transcendental meditation program for more than 5 years were physiologically 12 years younger than their chronological age, and this is measured through reduction of blood pressure, better near-point vision, and auditory discrimination. So I'd like to hear from your panel some confirmation that this is indeed a very viable viable way that we can reverse our aging process?
Go ahead. Dr. Kay, go ahead.
There are many, many practices that have been proposed that might help slow the what's sometimes called the rate of aging. I think, though, that we actually don't know what the critical rate of aging is. Many of the component pieces, blood pressure, body mass, things like that, don't always add up to the complete individual's aging rate. And these processes, these kinds of interventions like transcendental meditation, dietary interventions, dietary supplements.
Vitamin, multivitamin?
Absolutely. They may have some effect, but my view is that they need to be tested with placebo-controlled or other kinds of contrasts in a blinded fashion. It's not always easy to do, but I think that as time goes on, we will actually begin to learn more about that. But I don't. My own view is that we aren't there yet.
Well, you can read the International Journal of Neuroscience and Journal of Behavioral Medicine, which both would show that when you control for the effects of diet and exercise, you still find that the biological age of people who practice transcendental meditation is, on average, 12 years younger. So I believe, and this is part of a body of research, it has over 600 scientific studies that are published in 110 peer-reviewed journals. So I think that the research has been done, and I know I've been practicing it now for 32 years, and I feel that it has definitely made me feel younger.
He's only 12.
He must
now.
Be 6 years old, right?
All right, Craig, thanks for calling. There are studies, but who would want to pay for a study where that no one's going to make any money on the product that they're studying?
Well, this is an important reason for the federal government, the NIH, private organizations. I happen to be president of the American Federation for Aging Research, which is a private philanthropy that supports particularly young scientists' aging research projects for exactly that reason, because we need more research about particularly behavioral, the complementary and alternative interventions, as well as new medications, which is the one thing that where there's an incentive for industry to do those studies. So I think that's a very important message, that we really need all kinds of ways of supporting these kinds of research studies.
All right, we're going to go take a question from the back, way in the back, this gentleman here. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Ira. I just want to say it's great to have your input on. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
You have the best two-hour science call-in show nationwide. There.
Write a letter to my boss saying that. Please, take your question.
This question, I guess, is for Dr. Castle. Dr. Castle, my wife is a physician in the area, and a lot of the stories she comes home with tend to strike a note with me that there seems to be an expectation with a lot of the elderly patients that we ought to be able to fix whatever's wrong with them. And the families especially feel this way, that they come in, there's something wrong, you know, we've got to be able to fix it, and there's not a lot of responsibility on their part for cooperating with recommendations about what they can do to stay, you know, healthy. They just want to come in, get a pill, and get fixed. Is that a cultural issue? Is that something that our medical schools need to do a better job of dealing with? That's the question.
It's an important question, and I think having some way to bridge those expectations between the patients and families and the healthcare providers is going to be vitally important to creating more productive aging society. Both sides of this have a complaint, it seems to me, which is legitimate. One is the patient's complaint, and as a geriatrician, I've heard time and time again patients come to us and say, well, the doctor said, well, you're just old. There's nothing I can do. And it turns out there is something you can do. The doctor should never say, there is nothing I can do. Maybe you can't do miracles, but you can almost always help somebody. And that's why geriatric medicine is so important, because you need to understand the little things you can do that actually can make a huge difference in someone's quality of life. On the other side of the interaction is the patient, who may have unrealistic expectations, in part because of what modern medicine and all our miracles have sold, in part because of what all the, you know, drug company advertising has sold, because of our looking for quick answers to complex problems. And so people may want a simple answer. I mean, I'll give you a good example is all of this evidence that we now have about physical activity and the importance of that in remaining strong and all of the good effects of that. Well, there's a fair amount of research now being done that certain kinds of hormones, like growth hormone, can actually mimic some of those effects. You just get a shot. Well, but growth hormone has all kinds of very scary side effects for people. But there are physicians who are setting up practices where they're giving people these shots because people would, of course, rather have a shot than have to work out for an hour every day. Mm-hmm. So there is kind of a cultural, educational thing that needs to take place here, but I think it's part of our profession's job to participate in that education as well.
Dr. Kutzer, do you get requests all the time or questions about, you know, people saying, I'm not getting old, you know? Well, don't tell me I'm getting old. That's not what I want to hear.
I think that what you're talking about here is change in health behavior and all the research on how hard it is to change individual health behaviors. As Chris said, trying to get people to exercise. We know about diet. We know about exercise. We know about stopping smoking. We know about the health behaviors that will enhance our lives, will reduce our possibility of getting diseases as we grow older, and will enhance our late life. But because they all take effort, because they take individual motivation, because they take time out of what are now everyone's ultra-busy lives, they're very, very difficult to implement. So it is a challenge on both sides.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a cultural change that needs to occur in terms of delivering medical care. As people get older, you were mentioning the need for a little extra time for your Jeopardy questions, or answers. The person who gets old, as they get older, actually is slower. Their cognitive processing is slower. And to conduct a medical interview and examination actually takes more time. That's a little bit at cross purposes with the famous, well, we only have 10 minutes to accomplish everything we need to do today. Right. Just to test memory appropriately, you probably do need a 10-minute delay from the time you present the information to the time you ask for it again. The appointment's over. You never got to ask the follow-up question. So I think those kinds of changes, they will need to happen. They probably will because everybody's getting older.
And this is the black hole of our health system now.
That's right. And so we're hearing right now, one more time, a debate about how should we, quote, fix Medicare, unquote. And that's a debate that's going to continue to go on because we don't have the answer yet. I think the very broken healthcare system that we have is especially broken when it comes to older people, but it is the only part of the population that has any kind of universal insurance, so they understandably don't want to let go of it.
Mm. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about health issues this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Here in Portland, Oregon, it's Brain Awareness Week, and we're taking questions about the brain and health. I'll go here and then here. Let me back to the end there.
Hi, I teach nursing locally in the area. I'm very interested in health and wellness and how it applies to healthy aging. The Institute of Medicine's Food and Nutrition Board has provided advice on food and exercise. And my understanding is the panel has concluded that Americans should get at least 60 minutes per day of moderately intense exercise. Clearly, engaging in physical exercise is of great benefit for healthy aging. Do you think these types of recommendations may create some additional challenges for healthy aging, especially for those people who thought that 30 minutes per day was doing exactly that for them? Thank you.
That's a very good question because it is confusing getting at this point of what does the public really understand, having all these conflicting research messages come out. And I think the answer is that something is better than nothing. And here I think if you can do 60 minutes of physical exercise a day, then that's great. If you can do 30, that's good too. And I think there isn't a threshold amount. I mean, I'll give you another example. Very frail older people, people who are in nursing homes or very frail living at home, can benefit from just that extra walk across the room or very small free weights, weightlifting. We in our doctor's offices have little free weights that while you're talking to the patient, doing the memory test that Jeff's talking about, you say, okay, let's lift this thing. So even just a little bit can matter, and more is better.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Question right here.
Hi, Ari. I have a two-part question, actually. The first question is for Dr. Kay. In your study, are you factoring in race? I have a couple of questions about that. Specifically, are there differences by ethnicity or race among rates of Alzheimer's between African-Americans and, say, European-Americans? And my second question is for generally the panel. And what factors account for the, on average, lower lifespan of African-Americans compared to white Americans?
That's the right guy, I think, this question.
Those are excellent questions, very important questions. And actually, in some ways, that question gets a little bit about at this question of environment and where you live and who you are. There was a fabulous study that was completed which looked at African-Americans in Indianapolis, and compared these elderly African-Americans in Indiana to individuals in Nigeria, Ibadan, Nigeria. And they used the same exact assessments, the same teams compared notes, so there was no difference in the way they assessed the individuals. And what they found was that the incidence of Alzheimer's disease was actually lower in Africa. And knowing what we know about genetics, it's unlikely that there was a genetic change in the course of, 100 years in these two populations. So it leads us to believe that there's actually some environmental factor that was causing these differences. I think that we make a lot of assumptions. It's another topic for Science Friday about this question of genetics, ethnicity, but more importantly, I think where a person lives and their locality may actually be a key factor.
Go ahead. We have to take a break soon, but there is the African-American Dementia and Aging Project.
Yes, right? I wanted to mention that as well. There's a gentleman here in Portland, Fred Miller, who is the principal investigator of this project, where he's looking at the influence of stress as measured by being an elderly African-American. There actually are scales to measure ethnicity actually acculturation. And he believes that some people who have more stress because they are trying to be more acculturated or less acculturated may have some influence on how well your brain ages as you get older.
All right, we're going to have to take a short break, interesting, and come back and talk lots more about aging. So stay with us. We'll take more questions from the audience and from the phones. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A brief program note. On this hour on Monday, join Neil Conan and his guests for the latest news and analysis as the buildup to a possible war continues. That's on the next Talk of the Nation in this hour on Monday. We're talking this hour about healthy aging with my guests, Dr. Elizabeth A. Kutza, Dr. Jeffrey Keg, Dr. Christine Castle. And your questions, 1-800-999-8255. Before we go take a few more questions, Dr. Kutza, I want to talk to you about a really interesting situation that we're all facing. A lot of older people who thought they were retiring and going back to work with the economy. Mm-hmm. And people thought, I thought I'd be retired now. Is that a special issue that aging people are having trouble dealing with now?
We've been talking a lot about individual aging, about the aging body, the aging brain, but we haven't spoken a lot about the social context that people are aging in now, and that's certainly changing as cohorts of older people are coming into the ranks, as it were. We know that we've had terrific changes in just the number of older people we have in the society. We've gone from about 3 million at the beginning of 1900 to about 37 million at the beginning of 2000. Each generation is having a slightly different experience. The current generation that we're looking at and kind of worrying about has to do with the baby boom generation. That's going to be those who are the folks born between 1946 and 64, one of the biggest population bulges we've had in America. And they'll start coming into the ranks of the over 65 in around 2010. And what we're finding in surveys that are looking at that group is that they really feel as though they're not going to have as good a life in old age as their parents had, for
example. Something very unusual, isn't it?
Something very unusual, that instead of a trajectory upward, saying we're always going to do better than the generation ahead of us, we're seeing that there is concern, worry. For example, when I was listening to the news and they talked about Intel dropping again 6%, I thought, oh, there goes some more of my retirement income. The fact is that now people are more reliant on a rather uncertain job market, an uncertain economy. There's been a sea change in the way pensions are now being offered, whereas our parents had what we called defined benefit plans, sort of guarantee lifetime mm-hmm. annuities. Now most of us at work are involved in what are called defined contribution plans, very heavily reliant on the stock market. We see a lot of news stories about the decline in that. So the retirees, people who are pre-retirement, who are sort of facing it in the next 10 to 20 years, are saying, I don't think I'm going to be able to live as well as my parents. I don't think I'll be able to have a retirement income as generous. I think I'm going to have to continue working, either full-time or part-time. And we've certainly seen, even in Social Security, there is now, between 2003 and 2026, I think it is, there's going to be a gradual increase in the what we call normal retirement age, from 65 to 67. So the younger cohorts will have to wait longer.
That's going to be extra stress on those of us who want to get old and have that good outlook on life. You know,
It might be counterproductive to that.
Let me go to the phones, take a question, and then we'll go to the audience here. So let's go to Larry in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Is it Manitowoc, Larry?
Yes, Ira. Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy your show. I just have a question. I think I learned this one. I was a social worker for 3 years in the early 70s. Now I'm in a different career in financial planning. But I found that most seniors that I saw in nursing homes were dramatically over-medicated. And generally, I'd get them off of 5-6 medications, and a lot of times their memories would come back, and they would function much better. And that helped me with my mother. When my mother turned 85 and lost my father, they put her on a number of drugs to relax her and calm her down. And about a month later, I took her back, and the doctor told me, I think your mother has the start of Alzheimer's disease. And says, I don't know about that, because I think maybe she just has too many medications. And when we got her off those medications, her memory came back, and she's fine. She's 98 now. She still speaks French and is doing well. And each one of us, there's three boys, we each have helped take care of my mother. And I think that's a part of it. I think a lot of seniors, because of the way families are spread around today, they don't get the family care they got years ago, like both my grandmothers died at home. I was at the home when they died, and so we've kind of given my mother tender, loving care. And I think without us being there supporting her, she probably would have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's and been in a nursing home today.
Mm-hmm. I'll get some comments.
Let me just say that I couldn't have told that story better myself, so I thank you for it. This is exactly why we need better teaching in all medical schools about geriatric medicine, is because the brain is very susceptible to these effects of all these medications, and at the most extreme can mimic Alzheimer's disease, and then you stop the medication and the person's memory comes back. But sometimes it's even more subtle and can create actual depression, which then leads to all these other problems and medical conditions and not interacting and other kinds of problems. And so rather than add more medications to treat the depression, sometimes you can just find the medication that's causing it and stop that medication. But it means that you have to have someone who really understands these side effects. I would just add one other thing. Obviously, families have an important role in this, and everybody who's listening to this show should be asking these questions. As Beth said, when if you take your parent to the physician or interact with them in some way, and don't forget about over-the-counter medications. With all of our enthusiasm about complementary and alternative medicines and supplements and things you can just buy at the drugstore, those can have the same effects as well.
Let me go to two questions. This gentleman's been waiting a while, and I'll come up front here. Yes, sir.
Hi, thanks. I have a question. We hear a lot about the aging body and the brain, but I'm interested in what comes between those two is the senses, and particularly as a musician, I'm interested in hearing. Why does it seem that without exception, high-frequency hearing loss goes along with aging, and what can I do to keep those high frequencies in my ears for as long as I can?
Well, that's a very important question. The immediate answer or the concrete answer is that the hair cells as in the ear that are responsive for receiving that information do decline normally with age. And as we were talking before, some people have a faster decline, and some people seem inherently to have a slower decline. A lot of that, though, is dependent on how much noise exposure you may have. So this is, I don't know whether you're a rock musician or a musician who has a little less ambient noise, but the key is to try to protect oneself from those known preventative kinds of environmental influences. It's very much like sun exposure. It's the same kind of thing. Our skin cells are more susceptible as we age to being less able to repair themselves. And so what we should be doing is not being exposed to too much sunlight.
1-800-989-8255. I'll get a question and I'll go to the floor. Oregon has been a pioneering state in addressing end of life issues. Of course, everybody knows about the state passing the Death with Dignity Act in 1997. And I'm wondering how, Dr. Castle, this awareness of the end of life issues has increased because of the Death with Dignity Act. People more aware of these issues now.
Well, I think they are, and I think that Oregon's leadership in this area has really shown people that how important it is that we attend to the issues of dignity as people face the end of life. The aging of society is a success story. We're all excited about how long we're going to be able to live, and we hope that those will be quality years. But the fact is that medical science has not created immortality. We will all die. And it is possible that those deaths can be made better, that people can suffer less, can have more meaning at this very profound moment of life, and that their families can be left with memories which aren't memories of nightmares, but memories of a dignified and meaningful closing. So to get that into the medical world, which has traditionally been very death-denying, except for the hospice program, which is the one example I think we've all learned from, we just need to be able to apply these principles throughout wherever people are, whether they're in hospitals, even in the intensive care unit, or in a nursing home, or at home. And I think that Oregon has really led the way in doing that.
I'm Ira Flato, and we're talking about Death with Dignity and other issues about aging on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We're here in Portland, Oregon, at the Oregon. let me just go to the. I'm running out of time, so I don't want to rush. Go ahead, gentlemen. I have this woman right here. She's been standing here for a while. I'll go to you. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm curious about research into the effect of cortisol on the memory. There's a recent study came out. I think it was the University of Maryland, that one out of every 133 Americans is estimated to have gluten sensitivity, and it's understood by other research that gluten sensitivity increases the release of cortisol. And then Dr. Kutzer was talking about all the anxiety we baby boomers have about our portfolios, which I'm sure raises our cortisol levels. And I understand that cortisol is particularly corrosive to the glia of the hippocampus, where concrete memory is based. So what do you know?
Dr. Kay?
Well, obviously, we can answer this in about 60 seconds, I'm sure, quite comprehensively. There are many, many hormones, many physiologic processes that clearly are enhanced or actually depressed by stress. And at a basic level, stress is probably not good. The exact, how that stress physiologically ultimately relates to a person who is 100 years old and able to remember really well as opposed to somebody who isn't, we really don't know. But I think that you're right, and the shortest answer we can give right now is that those basic mechanisms, those aging mechanisms, as Dr. Castle was saying, those that might basically determine how rates of change over a lifetime are controlled, probably have a component of cortisol that's very important.
What tools as a researcher do you need to develop or have? If you had, I always give scientists on my program, because we can, a blank check to write for themselves and say, what would you do?
I can give you the address to send it to.
What? We split it. Tell us what you, in basic research, where you stand, what would you like to know, what kind of tools do you need to find that out?
I'm very, I'd have to say, seduced by the genetic component because it's fixed. I think the environment is actually more important in the sense that that's why we are living as long as we do now. But at least we now have in our grasp, we know the human genome essentially in its broad outline, and I think we can begin to really make a statement as to how the genes are controlling our rates of aging and how we get to be successful agers.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cassidy?
Can I have that checked?
You
too,
can have part. We'll split it.
Now
because
it's three ways.
The other side, and I would guess that Beth would go along with me on this. The other side is the rest of our lives and how that influences aging. The MacArthur study, which looked at successful aging, found that something like only 30% of why we age successfully is medical, and 70% of it is this mixture of environmental, socioeconomic factors. We talked about the issue of the ethnic and racial differences. A lot of that is mixed up with socioeconomic factors and how communities are set up for people to be active or not. All of that is much more expensive to study, actually, than the genetics of it, because you have to study populations, you have to develop much more extensive information systems and have a lot more people involved in studies like that. So we need at least part of the check to go to that aspect, the social aspect.
Mm-hmm. I'll give Dr. Kutz, you can jump in on the check also here.
I can jump in on the check, okay. I think an area that we still need considerable research on has to do with the very late life.
But you only have 15 seconds
okay,
to do
I would look at the area of how people live in the very late life when they can't any longer live independently, where the issue of either the nursing home care, the home care, we need to really know better how to sustain and support the best quality of life we can for people who are very frail and who may be cognitively impaired.
All right. And we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests this hour, Dr. Elizabeth Kutza, who is director of the Institute on Aging at Portland State University, Dr. Jeffrey Kay, director of geriatric neurology at Portland Veterans Administration Hospital, and director of the Latent Aging and Alzheimer's Disease Center at Oregon Health and Science University, and Dr. Christine Castle, who is dean of the School of Medicine at the Oregon Health and Science University and co-editor of the Practical Guide to Aging published by the New York University Press. Thank you all for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Berghoff. Charles Berquist is our web producer. Our intern is Adrian McDonald. If you'd like to write us, if you missed any of the things we talk about on Science Friday, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, you'll find Science Friday's Kids Connection, which is actually free material that we create with KidsNet out of the curriculum. There's free curriculum you can take to your schools out of the substances and the stuff we talk about on Science Friday. So surf over to there and you can also get back issues of Science Friday. You can listen to them online. You can download them into your portable player. I'm Ira Flato in Portland.